Well, the nice thing about recording this with you, James, is that very few people know what it's like to hold the microphone in the experience that we've had. But this is motor racing. I think potentially, if they were to let Max in, I think their regret would be that they overmanaged two very capable, proven drivers.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. This week, we meet one of the small group of broadcasters who can call themselves an F1 TV commentator. Alex Jakes is the voice of Channel 4's F1 coverage in the UK and on the F1 International feed and F1 TV, alongside former F1 drivers David Coulthard and Jolyon Palmer. Alex worked his way up through F2, eSports, and series like the W Series, and by 2018, he was a full-time F1 commentator. He was voted Commentator of the Year in the 2022 Broadcast Sports Awards, and his voice has appeared in Drive to Survive and on F1 video games. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great hearing you do that introduction as someone who watched your commentary growing up. That's a surreal feeling to hear you read that out.
Okay. Well, let's dive into this. I mean, we've got something in common, clearly, in that we've both spent significant amounts of time commentating on live Formula One Grand Prix on television. What do you enjoy most about life in the commentary box?
I honestly think it's working with my co-commentators and the collaboration. I think that's potentially where I've been the luckiest, because when you're able to extract, say we go back to Budapest last year, when you're able to extract DC's life experience, same team, go back in time, you've been given a team order and you've got the latter part of a race to think about it, being able to get an answer that maybe the audience wouldn't be able to hear elsewhere, I think that is one of my favorite parts. His play-by-play of what Lando Norris was thinking in that moment, having sat in that very same seat in Jerez in Australia in 1998, is the part of the job that I love. It's just communicating the story. And I think the best way that you do that, obviously I'm there to identify who's in what order and tell everyone the background, but you extract people who've been there and done that, and you get the real, this is what they're thinking moment. I love that part of the job.
Was part of the appeal for you that you're putting the soundtrack on a sporting moment? I mean, people love sport. One of the few examples of real suspense most people get in their lives, you know, otherwise it's manufactured, like with fiction and scripted shows on Netflix and what have you. But yeah, when you're a sports commentator, you're putting a soundtrack on a moment that's forever fixed. If you're lucky, you get a few where it's forever fixed in people's memories. And yeah, was that part of the appeal for you?
Not in that way. I think the appeal, trying to work your way to the commentary box, is I want to be part of this. I think this is the coolest sport in the world, the most exciting sport in the world. I'd be watching every race. I'd be consuming all the articles on Autosport if I wasn't. And I know that for a fact. If I wasn't working on it, and I know that for a fact because that's what I did growing up. That was the obsession growing up, and I you know, absolutely adored watching every minute of it. Try and read every book, try and read every magazine. It was the passion. It was the thing that I loved. So it wasn't so much, oh, I could be the soundtrack to these big moments. It was I could be in the arena, in the back row of the grandstand, watching where it happens, working with people who've been there, and I love broadcasting. So I think no matter where I'd have ended up in broadcasting, could have been behind the microphone, could have been behind the camera. I love the mechanism of making radio and podcasts and TV. But the thing that I was most passionate about was Formula One. So naturally you aim there. And then the soundtrack thing, you sort of appreciate it afterwards. And I'm sure you've had this thing of being like, wow, I was part of that. I'm part of, you know, Brazil 2008 always springs to mind immediately to be having, it took me a long time to actually get put out on site at Interlagos. So to know the atmosphere, to imagine that for a title decider must have been something else. So that's, the soundtrack thing is more something that you appreciate after you've been attached to some big moments rather than on the way up.
It's funny you picked that example because after the race that night, I was out and about in Sao Paulo and I was invited to the McLaren end of season party, which obviously was a celebration.
Yes.
And Lewis was there and the mechanics were all going crazy and what have you. And I had a word with him and I remember saying to him, I'm really glad that I got to put the soundtrack on your first World Championship, and we had a bit of a chat about that. And I think the sort of magnitude of what he'd just achieved was still sort of sinking in on him. But for me, it was like, it was very much that, because I grew up with, like, you know, the great sports commentators and Harry Carpenter and the Ali fights and things. And it was always about, it was always, you know, the magic was finding the right words to describe the moment. So, I mean, you talk to a huge audience on Channel 4 and F1 TV, and the F1 TV audience, because takes you outside the UK, takes you to the US in particular and many other markets around the world. You're standing there holding this microphone in your hand, or maybe you've got a headset style microphone, I don't know. But the point is, you know that there are millions of people listening.
Yeah.
Do you ever get nervous? How do you prepare yourself? How do you get into it?
So on the microphone, let's answer that. Still the old school microphone. I don't know if you had a headset or a mic.
No, but Murray gave me his microphone, so I used it.
Wow, you don't turn that down, do you? I've always preferred that. I think you just get into a muscle memory of it. In terms of being nervous, I used to get nervous. I used to get nervous in the F2 and F3 days, GP2, GP3 days, when I started, because it meant the world. You know, I didn't expect to have that opportunity the year I got it. So the first year was not a nervy panic, but I found myself going from doing local radio and working for a sports agency and traveling around the United Kingdom covering any sport that would have me, working 9 to 5 for a newspaper, and then at the weekend keeping my hand in the broadcasting. And then I'd sent a demo in expecting to be on the radar for the future, and they were like, okay, well, you can do a couple of races for us. Are you available for Bahrain next week? And you were like, oh my word, that's a massive leap from going from the back of the grandstands to the back of a TV gallery. It wasn't the commentary box. So not only are you on site doing what was then GP2, but you are in the back of the gallery with everyone. Who's this guy? Who's this new guy that's done it? So that was pressure. So I got nervous in those days, because you're trying to find, you know, how you want it to sound, you know, the mechanisms that you have available to you. But it took me a couple of seasons to get it where I wanted it to be. So my brain would have the intention, and then occasionally it just wouldn't quite sound right. Then I know Hockenheim 2016, it started to sound how I wanted it to sound. I felt I had control over the broadcasts. And the thing that eradicates the nerves is the prep. If I prep correctly, if I'm happy with, I've got my pieces of paper in front of me and I've got all the information laid out, there's an awful lot of information available in this day and age, but I still have my own personally written stat sheet. I still have my notes on all of the drivers personally written out, because I want the information color-coded and laid out and all of these nerdy commentary things. If that's how I want it, no, the nerves aren't there. But the nerves would be there for season opener, British Grand Prix, and a title decider. Very likely we're going to get a title decider. And at that point, you're like, yeah, this is what you've worked for. This is why you've put the hours in. And you know, in those early years of going around the country, carrying around an ISDN box that you'd borrowed from local radio, like, you're making a loss in those days. So yeah, it's in, and you might be missing a party or a wedding or something like that. And so those are the moments that you work for. Most of the time I'm just excited for the race to begin rather than nervous.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, what all sports commentators live for is great moments of sporting drama and competition. And we're speaking now with 4 rounds to go in the 2025 World Championship, and it feels like it's reaching a really exciting crunch time. A 3-way title fight, I think there's no doubt about that whatsoever. How do you read the way that it's swung this season between Piastri, Norris, and the very significant cameo and growing importance of the cameo of Max Verstappen?
Well, the nice thing about recording this with you, James, is that very few people know what it's like to hold the microphone in the experience that we've had. But is this ringing any bells from 2007 for you? Because we've had, it's not the intensity of the McLaren civil war between Hamilton and Alonso. So it's not had that pure, visceral, almost hatred at points between the two contenders. And that was almost too good to be true. New contender, current world champion. They let Kimi in at the end on the rails. There are parallels that McLaren have potentially overmanaged the situation. I think if they'd continued to have the car advantage, it would have made sense to get to the constructors, manage it until you've won the constructors, and then leave it alone. I think they have probably overstepped when you've got drivers on the radio going, I don't think that was a fair penalty, swap us over. There's a slow stop, swap them over. Oh, we were wheel banging at turn three, swap them over. This is motor racing. And I think potentially if they were to let Max in, I think their regret would be that they overmanaged two very capable, proven drivers who, Lando's got a European Formula 3 championship. He knows how to close out a title. Oscar's won Formula Renault, Formula 3, Formula 2. They've been there and done that. There's a point where you can't intervene. You just have to let them scrap it out. And I think we've arrived there now, but Max Verstappen's in a situation, and he said it in press conferences this year, whereby he's got four in the back pocket. He knows he's at his peak. He knows he can go off to the Nordschleife and just win when he wants. He's aware of how good he is. He's command of where to put the car. As we saw again in Mexico, it's just unbelievable. So he's able to hit home runs, consistently swing for the fence, over and over and over again. And the other two are trying to carry the vase across the line with a slippery floor. And that's what's happened until, you know, Lando's obviously had a great result at a good time. But trying to win your first is a lot different than trying to win your fifth, and knowing that your fifth would be the most extraordinary comeback and the sort of thing that people talk about forever. No wonder he's reveling in that role in this year's World Championship.
All three of them have at some point had a kind of run of races, three, four races, where they've kind of won two or three and maybe finished second in the other one. Lando did it before the summer. Max did it, obviously, famously, just up until the US. Piastri's done it. If any of them does that now, they'll be the world champion. But do you think it's actually going to play out that way? Or do you think it's going to be more shared out and therefore more exciting as we in this final showdown?
No, I think it will be shared out, because even if you look at those run of races, like you say, Lando got on a roll before the summer break in Europe. It still felt like Oscar was quickest. Oscar was winning in Zandvoort. It felt like Lando's being, to be honest, it's felt like Lando, ever since he got the front end sorted on that car, the Canadian Grand Prix, it's felt like he's been able to access more of his talent in a way that at the start of the year, Piastri just stole his start. The entire Formula One paddock expected Lando to get off to a very quick start, win a lot of the first six races and control the championship. That was the expectation from Bahrain testing. So for Oscar to steal that start and assume that mantle has been really surprising. But I think the tracks coming up will favour all of them in different ways. I think the one, if it rains in Brazil, we saw how good Max was there last year. In the dry, that is a McLaren track. It's as simple as that. In Vegas, McLaren will then have to go and limit the damage. It's a street circuit. It's low grip. You're going to be sliding around. We've seen what's happened when we've gone to a Montreal. McLaren faded back. Max appears and Red Bull appear to have developed the car. So I think you are going to get ebbs and flows. I think you are. And to be honest, I think minimizing the damage like Max did in Mexico, he could have easily been fifth on Sunday. To turn a fifth into a second, I think is going to decide the world championship.
And the other thing is that you've got two sprint weekends in there. So it's not it's not just, if we were just looking at four Grand Prix, 25 points times four, that's one thing. But you've got sprint races in there, one of which is in Brazil and the other one is in Qatar. And that's 16 points. That's an extra 16 points that I think will actually be decisive, particularly given that Verstappen is the kind of undisputed king of the sprint race. So come on then, who's your money on for the championship?
If it's dry in Brazil, I think it'll be Lando. If it's wet in Brazil, I think it'll be Max.
It's not going to be Piastri at any price, you think?
I think it will be hard for him to, just on the evidence of the last few races, I think that that McLaren now suits Lando better.
You're listening to the James Allen and F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1 channel.
So listen, part of the reason you're here, apart from it's always nice to talk to a Formula One TV commentator, is that you've released a book, Grid to Glory, which takes 75 key moments from F1 history in this F1's 75th anniversary year, But it's not one of these things where you grab one happening per year and make some sort of formulaic thing. What I like about this book is it's much more interesting than that. For example, you have the kidnapping of an F1 world champion driver. Mm. You have the day that the F1 drivers all went on strike, or most of them, and many other great tales that newer fans to the sport might not necessarily know about. Was that the point of the book for you? And is that the target audience?
Not entirely, but that was the starting point. So a publisher approached me and said, do you want to write a commentator's diary of the 2024 season? Few things happening that year that I thought, not the best time to write a commentator's diary. So it morphed into this idea. And then I just wanted to tell the appealing moments and not just go back through and go, this race was important, this race was important. I wanted to go through and find the nuances that make Formula One as exciting as it is. And the appeal was that, yeah, sometimes the world champion does get kidnapped. Sometimes Niki Lauda takes all the drivers on strike and they're all in a... I couldn't work out of the contemporary accounts whether it was a ballroom or a conference room, but can you imagine the entire grid not only holed away in one room, but forced to sleep in that room overnight as well. There's so many great accounts with that. So it was intended for newer fans to be a backstory. You hear all these names that we mention on there. So, you know, we keep mentioning that Oscar Piastri would join Alan Jones and Sir Jack Brabham. Sir Jack Brabham, who nearly gave it up to be a truck driver. I mean, that's absolutely impossible in the modern age. And yet that's a name that we're still mentioning on the broadcast. Jack Brabham's influence on Formula One cannot be overstated. So that completely changes the history of the championship. You've got drivers who might not be able, you've got team owners that might not be able to become the characters that they come. Drivers wouldn't be able to buy a secondhand Brabham. And then you've just got the nature of a three-time world champion in there as well. So we'd have had different champions. So it's crazy the amount of sliding door moments. And I tried to focus on some of those. But also for more, you know, experienced petrol heads who've been watching for a long time, I tried to come at the known moments from a different angle. So, for instance, Frank Williams's crash is told from the perspective of Ginny Williams and how hard she had to fight to keep her husband alive. So tried to tell the known stories from a different angle and tried to provide the new fans. And we've got so many of the new fans. Someone put it to me that they don't know the name Stirling Moss. They don't know the name Sebastian Vettel. So I was like, in that case, let's tell it with some twists and turns and some unusual stories as well.
What are your personal favourite stories from the book?
I love the driver strike. I absolutely love it.
Tell us the story.
So the driver strike is that Niki Lauda, incredible character. I mean, having gone through the entire history of Formula One, he really does stand as a colossus across all the drivers that I wrote about. He reads the small print of the super license, and the small print...
What year are we in?
We're in 19... Ooh, that's a very good point.
81, 82?
I think we're in 82. I think we're in 82. We are in 82. We're in 1982. Niki Lauda has read the small print of the super license, which says that the drivers have to commit to the teams, but the teams can fire the drivers and leave them on the sidelines. Funnily enough, this has gone down terribly with the drivers who do not want to be benched and have their entire livelihood in the hands of, let's be honest, this is not modern Formula One team bosses. This is 1980s team bosses. So you've got some big beasts at this time. Like the likes of Colin Chapman, Enzo Ferrari, for example. So he puts a camp chair up at the paddock entrance and says, hi, have you read your super license? Now, this is Formula One. If you did this today, half of the grid wouldn't have read the small print of their super license. And they go, oh, no, that's not ideal. So he gets them all on a bus and they go off to the hotel. Jochen Mass misses the bus. So he slinks off home. He's unhappy. So he has to go back, and then it's this bizarre situation where you have Pironi going to negotiate with the FIA and with Bernie Ecclestone, and then you have the rest of the grid amusing themselves stuck in a hotel. You've got the team managers banging on the door, threatening the drivers at the back of the grid with a sack immediately. No one's going to do that to like Gilles Villeneuve, but like the drivers at the back are like, well, you're never getting in the car again. And you get some lovely levity in that one of the teams at the time, ATS, had a cardboard cutout which said, F1 drivers wanted, inquire within. And you're just like, this is the season opener. Can you imagine if we got to Melbourne next year and you've got Haas with a sign that say, drivers wanted, inquire within. It eventually got resolved and it ended. But it's a glorious farce in the middle of politics and then eventually a great Grand Prix, which I thought summed up the World Championship quite well.
Which other ones, potential ones, did you have on a long list that didn't make the cut? Any you regret leaving out?
There's lots of... So I know the last 30 years of Formula One history almost off by heart, and there were lots that I adored that I wanted to put in there and to tell in greater detail. You know, things like Brazil 2008, which had to be merged with Hamilton's move to Ferrari, which, hey, print deadline seemed like a good chapter to chuck in at the time, but never mind, you live and learn. Where we submitted it in April. But yeah, I think that there are so many stories to tell, but I was conscious that I had to do justice to the early years. So, you know, the Fangio getting kidnapped one is ridiculous, but also the one I adore is Stirling Moss pulling the wool over everyone's eyes in the Argentine Grand Prix of 58, where he's in the bar going, oh, I've got no chance to win this. This is, have you seen how long it takes to get the wheels off my car? It's going to be a 4-minute pit stop. I've got no chance. And then it's all by design. It's all by a plan for everyone to go, well, okay, Moss isn't the problem. We're not going to worry about Moss. And then he does a no stopper, which you could do in the rules at the time. And I think just the fact that Grand Prix was half won at the bar is amazing. And it's the first one I could find that was purely one on strategy as well. So I didn't want to just have 30 years of here are the races that I adored. Here are the twists. And I did chuck the one about the Ferrari barge boards in, which I'm sure you remember.
I was in the room.
You remember very, very well.
I was in the room where Ross Brawn came out and explained it. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are the ones that, you know, you read about it and you like, you can't believe, oh my word, they've disqualified the Ferraris. Those are the ones from the childhood. And that's the first full season I watched all the way through. So that meant a lot. So there would have been way more of late 90s, early 2000s in there. So, but that had to go on the cutting room floor so that we could tell the great stories like Moss winning a Grand Prix at the bar.
It's so the F1 mentality, that, isn't it? Even set back that early on. I think, as the listeners can tell, with a lot of these stories, you find yourself saying, can you imagine that happening in F1 today? But the thing about this sport is it is full of extreme characters, you know, and we've already talked about so many examples. I mean, 2007, you know, what happened within McLaren, the Spygate element of that, as far as it related to Ferrari and all the rest of it. I mean, things you literally just could not make up. We've just had a Hollywood movie made about Formula One, and people were saying that's a bit far-fetched. But, you know, we've all lived through things that you're just like, really? Does this really happen? So which one did you find the most bizarre when you were researching it?
I think Damon Hill being fired via a front cover of Autosport is the one where I was like, listen, there is, let's call it robust driver management in the 80s and 90s. I was like, can you imagine Lando Norris? You know, the front page of Autosport says Norris given the chop by McLaren. You'd be like, what earth is going
on? While he's winning a world championship.
Whilst he's doing the job. So I found that just nearly impossible to understand. And I know the backstory and I know the details and why they felt they had to get rid of Damon. And at the time, Heinz-Harald Frentzen was spoken about in the same breath as Schumacher. Everyone's excited for the next driving talent, but to do it mid-season and to allow it to break in the middle of the year in July when he's on his way to the title, and it clearly affected his performance. And he went through the ringer for it, and 90s journalism did not have some of the nuances that we have today. You're in the middle of tabloid wars as well in the United Kingdom, so some of the headlines were brutal. They were blunt and brutal. So that one, I was like, that is just that's extraordinary that was possible. And the rest of them, there's, as you say, there's strands all the way through in that the politics is constant. The inter-team battles is constant, but the drivers being heroes is always the center. That never changes from race one to the Mexico City Grand Prix.
Talk to me about some of the, as you've researched this, some of the drivers that you've kind of learned more about, the drivers you didn't commentate on that you wish you had.
I think the Prost and Senna battle just gets the blood pumping, because they were, from all the accounts at the time, just extraordinarily different characters. Two of the all-time greats put together, and the drama that it gives us, it's in a nice TV age, isn't it, where we have enough pictures, but we don't have complete pictures. But I don't think it's any coincidence that the resurgence of Formula One documentaries and interest in the sport begins with the Senna story. But it's the Senna and Prost rivalry at the center that electrifies that documentary. And I would have loved to have covered those battles, just purely because to have such different characters in a beautiful car, consistently them year in, year out, that is something I would have loved to have commentated on.
Well, last week on the podcast, we heard Adrian Newey talking about his, albeit sadly too brief, experience of working with Ayrton Senna, and the thoroughness and attention to detail outside of the car, but also in the car, the supreme confidence and concentration and just exceptional skill of Senna as a driver. And he then went on to directly compare Verstappen with Senna, which I thought was very, very interesting, particularly in the sense that whatever's going on in his life, he could just completely shut it out when he got into the car, put the helmet on, go out and just be the very best version of himself consistently all of the time. I mean, do you find yourself reappraising Verstappen, particularly this season, I think? I mean, he's won four world championships. Whatever you might think about the way 2021 was decided, he has won four world championships and has deserved them. But have you found yourself this year just reappraising just the level that he's actually on?
The level he can reach is extraordinary. And I felt that towards the end of last year when he was able to keep himself afloat. He's staring. It's incredible. This year, he's trying to overturn the biggest deficit. Last year, he was trying to defend the nightmare of losing the biggest deficit. And I think if you go back to Brazil, I wrote a retrospective on the Brazilian race and went through the detail of it, and we ran qualifying in the race on the same day, and genuinely I think Lando Norris would have gone to breakfast, because we started at 7:30 in the morning for qualifying. I think he would have gone to breakfast believing he was going to be the world champion, because Verstappen was way at the back of the grid, Norris is at the front, that McLaren was working everywhere they went. I think his ability to show, when it's one thing if you know that you go into winter testing and you know you've got a shocking car, and you know you're going to be on the defensive. But to start the season, like he did in 2024, with the same as he had in 2023, win, 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 win. And then to have to almost improvise a response, I was so impressed with that. Because it was just a totally different skill set. A totally different skill set. And then this year, he knows he can rattle off victories. He knows he can turn, because of last year, he knows he can turn fifth places into second. We now know he can keep it out of the wall at turn one, rally style, with a car fat with fuel at enormous speed. Because at the time, and this is why it's so nice to talk to you, your brain, you have so many places to look on an opening lap that you almost make decisions before they've happened. So I was like, I think he's going to hit the wall there. So I'm going to look at the next car, because I've got to talk about what's going on. And if we cut to Max in the wall, I'll go back to that. If he's back on the track, it's not a problem. But I thought he was gone. I thought his race was toast at that point. But you have to make minor decisions on what you're going to talk about very, very quickly on opening laps. I haven't reappraised his ability, but I'm astounded at the level that he's hit in the last couple of years. Doesn't even feel like we've reached the top of it either. And that's what Piastri and Norris have to deal with. And I think they know it. That's the thing. The one thing I get the feeling of with the drivers is that they do appreciate, and maybe you can speak to how it was with Michael Schumacher, but and the drivers at the time, but I think they do appreciate that Max has got things that they can't quite do for some of them yet, and for some of them they just can't access.
Well, it's interesting comparing him with Schumacher, because I think and especially because I obviously did a couple of books with Michael, that actually what one of Michael's greatest talents was being able to cover up his deficiencies, because he did have deficiencies. He didn't have the fastest reactions, for example, which one of the reasons why he didn't always make great starts, and sometimes it cost him, even cost him world championships. There were other things that he had to kind of cope with. Of course, he was extremely determined. He was an amazing team builder to a level that very, very few other drivers ever have been. Whereas with Max, I don't think he is necessarily covering up very many deficiencies. He was perhaps 5 or 6 years ago when he was tangling with Raikkonen into the first corner at Belgium and things like that. And he had some hot-headed moments. He was overly aggressive at times. He needed to find his way. But he's actually now entering his peak years, strictly speaking. I mean, he's in his late 20s. So that period from late 20s through to mid-30s is kind of peak years for a Grand Prix driver. So that's the scary thing, is actually, you know, he's already done what he's done, and he's still only really entering his peak years. But one of the stories that I really love, and again, it's one that I lived very intensely at the time, is the 2005 US Grand Prix at Indianapolis.
I was going to ask you about this if you didn't print it up. So this was always coming up.
Which, as many listeners will know, and some may not, is the infamous race that featured only 6 cars, because the Michelin tires that most of the field were running on couldn't handle the loads on the banking. Particularly turn one at Indianapolis, which the F1 cars were coming in the opposite direction, if you can picture that. And the Bridgestone teams, led by Ferrari, didn't want to find a solution using a makeshift chicane so that the fans could see a race in the full grid. And bear in mind, in those days, Formula One wasn't that big a deal in the US. It had struggled for a long time to find a home, to find a consistent home in America. And it was very much a niche of a niche sport in the US. So I commentated on that one for ITV, and it was one of the most interesting experiences I had, I think, in the role, because it was front and back page news at the same time. And you had about 3 different narrative strands going on, including the one that was going on off the track and beer cans being thrown on by the fans and everything. And I remember at the time that many people said F1 is dead in the US after this, but how wrong they were.
Yeah. A bit of a risk. A bit of a risk they took with it, wasn't it? I honestly thought at that point, having gone through all of the eras, I think that is the only point, and you're in the paddock for this entire time. So that's the only point where I was like, the politics is overwhelming the sport here. This is borderline ridiculous, in that the big beasts of the era were beginning to take shots at each other in a way that was beginning to get detrimental. Now, I can understand why Ferrari didn't want to fix that, because the rules have been changed, so they didn't win the title that year. I think we'd all have a similar approach if we'd been on a great run and suddenly the rule book had changed against us for that reason. But it did feel like there were always threats of breakaway championships at that point. The teams were clubbing together. From your point of view at the time, and obviously you're behind the microphone at that point, and the one thing I think all commentators can agree is you want the best action possible. Did you feel the politics was beginning to mess with the sport in a way that was hurting on-track action?
Yes, but that wasn't unusual in those days. There were quite a few things. And in fact, while you were talking, I was just thinking that there was another kind of agenda at work here, which is in those days we had Michelin and Bridgestone competing. So there was a tyre war. And that was good on the one hand, because it meant that it made things quite unpredictable. Yeah. But on the other hand, it made the sport extremely expensive, because they were constantly tyre testing. And Ferrari alone had a $25 million a year testing budget from Bridgestone. So imagine, I remember one of Schumacher's guys saying to me that he'd been away 230 nights that year.
Wow.
Because constantly, as well as racing and promotional stuff, there was just so much testing going on. And Michael liked to do as much of the testing as he could himself. So, but what was going on was a bit of opportunism on the part of Max Mosley, the then FIA president.
Yeah.
Michelin have made a mistake. They've left themselves vulnerable. I think he wanted to embarrass them in the biggest possible way. And sure enough, they left the sport not long afterwards. Yeah. And you were able to go down to having only one tyre supplier. But as you said a minute ago, this was a gamble that they were taking with, from a promotional point of view. That's not something that Liberty Media run F1 would ever, ever even contemplate. Hmm. Why would we risk our product?
Yeah.
Why would we risk our image in a market for a political gain, you know? And it was quite extraordinary. But I mean, that's perhaps why Formula One wasn't necessarily thriving and prospering in those days to anything like the extent that it has with the management of the sport today. I mean, you have to give them credit for, they're very clear on what they want. They want to reach new audiences.
Yeah.
And they're succeeding.
Yeah. I think that's the point where I just felt that the politics was beginning to really hurt not only the racing on track, but Formula One's appeal, so that the big beasts could argue with them themselves. As you say, it could have cost America, where we now have three Grand Prix, massive events. Every single time we're in the US, there is a week-long build-up to the Grand Prix itself. All the teams are doing extra events. All the sponsors are getting good value for money. It's amazing how quickly things can change in 20 years.
I remember the following year we went back to Indianapolis, and of course everyone was a bit unsure about how it was all going to go down.
Yeah.
And I was asked to host a thing called the Kiss and Make Up Party, which was basically inviting a load of fans down, and most of the drivers came.
Wow.
And did like Q&As on stage. And it was kind of, it was F1 recognizing, and it wasn't the driver's fault, but no, it was F1 kind of recognizing that, the community of F1 recognizing that they'd sort of dropped the ball the year before, and there we go. So, well, I could talk to you all day about these fantastic stories that you've managed to dig out. And it's just a very, very enjoyable book. And I think what you've managed to do, which I think is great, is you've managed to really humanize it. You know, it's so easy to talk about Formula One in terms of numbers.
Yeah.
And data and statistics and sort of just rehashing, you know, race commentaries, if you like, or race reports. But you've done something much more interesting, which is to bring out the human side of the sport. Because at the end of the day, you know, we love and marvel at the skill of the drivers, but it's the human being inside the crash helmet that is the fascinating thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's ultimately where the sport becomes extraordinary. And if you look at, let's take this year, if Oscar comes back from having lost all that points lead, what an extraordinary amount of resilience he will have shown. If Lando's able to close it out, having had that really tough start, and let's be honest, the world on his back telling him what he was doing right and what he was doing wrong. And then Verstappen being able to access this talent in a way that few others in the history of the sport have done. That the driver at the center of the car is still the most compelling thing, no matter the amazing spectacle that surrounds it.
Well, thank you very much, Alex. Keep doing what you're doing because you do it brilliantly. And so tune in to Alex on F1 TV or Channel 4. And his book, Grid to Glory, is out now, published by Michael O'Mara Books. It's really enjoyable read and a great gift for anyone who's into F1, and especially if they haven't been following the sport for very long. Remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllen on F1 on X. My thanks to producer Ben, and thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe, leave us a review and a rating, and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We'll be back with another podcast very soon.